This is Joe Leith speaking in Palm Springs in June of 1966, followed by a banquet of some sort.
I know how Joe likes to be introduced. He likes to be introduced as a wino and a drunk, and I'm sure of this because he reminded me of this. But I believe, and I've been told by the gentleman I mentioned, that when they start comparing speakers at AA, they always start at the second spot. This is from New York, all over the country. Joe is always given the number one spot in AA by all his close friends. And I am so privileged to be able to introduce to you tonight, from Tyler, Texas, Joe Leith. Here he is. Big hand for Joe.
I could remember that beautiful introduction so I could have it chiseled on my tombstone in one long sentence and let the pigeons punctuate it at their leisure.
Fellow sitting at the end of the table down there whom I had not
seen. He was the local undertaker. And the sweat was pouring from his face. And he made this profound statement, which I believe. He said, "From what you fellas say, I must be an alcoholic." So it's my firm conviction that this is a story handed down, that one must tell another. When I see a drunk in AA that's sober, I have double vision. I see another one somewhere that loved him while he got that way. So I'll tell you a little about me briefly. Maybe you can find an acre of pain in there somewhere. It was like yours. Oh, my case was different. I started drinking when I was 17 one night just to be accepted into a group of young fellows. And purely, I guess, for that reason, I didn't want them to call me a sissy. But I got drunk that night. Incidentally, I got drunk every time after that. There were six or seven of us in this group, and the booze did something to me that it didn't do to those other fellows. I found there that night the very elixir of life. Performed a great magic for me. When I felt bad, it made me feel good. When I was sick, it made me well. Now, it wasn't compulsive, I'm sure, at this time. But I went back to it again and again. Now, I know all these fellas today, most of them, and they still remain in that category of social drinkers, if there is such a thing. I have a very humble opinion about social drinking. And that is that if you take the most pious and unctuous old sister out of the church and slap about eight slugs of that gallo in her that I used to drink, she's going to become unsocial as hell. See, that as it may, I went back to it again and again. And I found myself a young chap of all places in Hollywood studying the designing of ladies' lingerie. This ain't a good business for a drunk. This is where you cut those soft, silk, sleazy, intimate things that the women wear. If any of you girls got a pinch, you've been gone for a long time. Not my fault. And I was considered a very skilled man in my profession. Had the whole world ahead of me, studying under a very eminent designer. And this is where I think I crossed from that, what is that line they talk about, that smart fellas in AA got a word for it, these college guys. We've got a step in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the second one. I believe that it infers to your, whether you got a gopher in the garden or not, you know. Well, if you cut a bunch of braziers with three of them blazes in them, you're nuts. I told a psychiatrist about that when I was taking my fifth step, and he said it was just wishful thinking. Well, needless to say, I cut myself out of that profession. And this is the beginning of the lie. When we come into AA, they talk about honesty and wasn't much wrong with mine, but how does a drunk ever get his second job if he tells about the first one? So it becomes a part of us in the very beginning. I hated to leave this. It was the only thing I knew. I'd been at it a long time. And this fine, kind, compassionate Jewish fellow came to me and he told me, he said, "Joe, you got to go. You're costing me too much money. said, "I can't tolerate you any longer." And he added in an aside, he said, "I have one thing to be thankful for, and that is that you weren't a rabbi or you would have destroyed our whole race." Pedro had bought out the back door of a union hall a plumber's license to go into the shipyard as a master plumber. This is the guy that has never picked up anything any heavier than a pair of scissors. And of course, you know I went in as a master fraud. Those were the days when you were, and this is revolting to think about, when you were frozen to your job. Do you remember those? I have a little pink piece of paper now that hangs over my den as a souvenir, and it's signed by the Department of War Labor, and it prohibits me from working within 25 miles of the city of Los Angeles. I thawed out. Well, here we go again. The beginning of the run. This is a family disease. There used to be a saying that floated around our society that we don't hear too much anymore, and I wish we did. And that's when a drunk gets well, 20 or 30 more people get well with him. This is so true. Now I begin to hurt everything that I touch. And I remember the conversations and self-justification. Let's get out of here and go somewhere else. Let's go somewhere else. And we started to move. And there's nothing wrong with that theory, actually, except for the fact that when I got there, I was there. Nothing had changed at all. And I wandered up into Northern California. And of all things, my choice of things to do was becoming less all the time, and I got a job on the railroad. And I would like to say here that they are a very narrow-minded group of people. They run more than one train on one track. It's a damn good thing you don't have to guide them. And I'm sure they felt that if a man was a little bit addled, that he would get them mixed up. And that's just exactly what I did. There is a place up in the top of the Sierras up here, if you remember the old days of steam trains, and we used to push cars up to the top of it, and it'd take four or five engines to get up there. Some of you will understand this vernacular. And we would push this train to the top of the mountain, and we went into what was called an interlocking system. And the railroad boasted that it was physically impossible to make a mistake up there. They had it in writing. And I did. By some peculiar alcoholic quirk of circumstance, I got two engines going towards one another with four cars between them, carrots, apples, lettuce, and celery. And I made the biggest goddamn fruit salad. People wanted to fire me. But the bad part of it was they had made this boast in writing that this place you couldn't make a mistake. And they flew two fellas out from the Sperry Company in the East, and they followed me for over 2 weeks trying to find out how I did it. didn't know. And I finally suggested to one of these gentlemen, if you'll buy me a quart, I'll try it again. Well, they didn't fire me. I had another alcoholic representing me at the investigation, and he proved some of the most atrocious lies. The old superintendent came out to me after it was over with, and he was highly indignant that they hadn't fired me. And he said, my friend, you have caused me a lot of trouble. And you should be arrested for even walking on our right-of-way. And if it's the last thing I do, I'm going to get you fired. Do you think that was any threat to an alcoholic? And from here on, it set in a siege of the most hellish existence that one can remember. Oh, you know, in AA, as we beat our gums about our suffering and how we rise above it, I think that maybe sometimes we place the great emphasis upon the physical suffering that we get from being alcoholics. I don't remember that too much. Yes, I remember the shakes and all that. But you know what I remember? I remember the humiliations and the indignities that I brought down upon myself and didn't have any answer to say why it was happening. Don't tell me that's not suffering. Then we go through the process of making excuses one for another. Oh God, when I see these guys coming in AA with the wife hanging on their arm, it does something to me. They who have made excuses for us endlessly and covering us up. I remember one of the neighbor ladies had the audacity to ask my wife one day, why do you live with a man like that? With her loving reflex, she said quickly, you don't know him when he's sober. And this old heifer said, well, when is he sober? The dodge, the excuse. No answer for why. Well, pressure gets pretty heavy. Can't stand it long. I remember one day I was drinking in this bar all day up in a little town called Roseville, California, next door to the office of one of our beloved AAs, a fellow named Floyd Yee. Was the only bar in which I could get credit, so I had to trade there. And I'd been asleep up there all day. This bar had sleeping facilities. You've been to that state of saturation where you were neither asleep nor awake. I got up about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and staggered down Main Street home, and we were living with my wife's sister. Oh, beautiful relationship. And I went in and lay down upon the bed, and they thought I was asleep. And this is the conversation that went on in the next room. My wife, in near hysteria, cried out to her sister and said, oh, what'll I do? What would you do if you were living with a man like that? And her sister didn't hesitate a moment. She said, I'd poison the son of a bitch. I was too poor to hire a food taster. They ate first. This insidious, guilty feeling that we carry with us that is beyond explanation, I think, until we find the love of AA. Well, the human body, it'll take so much. I got wine inadvertently.
That's a hell of a good word.
Don't laugh at the winos. Some brilliant people are winos. Wine's a great thing. Got some great medicinal perks. It'll cure hay fever. If you drink it like I did, you won't sneeze. The doctor has been trying for years to cure Tom's cold. I'll tell you, port wine does. Well, I got on it, as I said. I had befriended a little Irish bartender in the lobby of my hotel in Sacramento one day. And he came in with the shakes, a little Irish fella named J. O'Farrell. You can't get more Irish than that, can you? And I saw he was suffering, and I had a beautiful glow on, felt very benevolent that morning. And I said to him, "What's the matter, my friend?" And he told me, honestly, he said, "I got the shakes. I'm going to get thrown out of the hotel." I said, "Well, I can't help the hotel, but here's a $5 bill. Go get rid of the shakes." And it was one of the best investments I have ever made in my entire life. I followed that poor little bartender for over 4 years and drank over $5,000 worth of booze off of that $5 loan. If he didn't remember it, I reminded him. Got him fired from a place, and he went and got another job, and I was right on his back. How phony can he get? Well, one morning I went into Curly's place about 6 o'clock, and I remembered as though it were yesterday. He was swamping out 6 o'clock in the morning. I said to him, "Curly, I can't take my breakfast this morning." He knew what I meant. What is that high-sounding word, regurgitate? He was over there, and as benevolently as a soul could say it, I think all bartenders should have been psychiatrists anyway. And psychiatrists should have been something else. He said, "Over behind the bar, you'll find a jug of port wine there." And he made this statement verbatim. He said, "You can take a couple of drinks of that and go back to whiskey." And I would like to say to you, my friends, I have never been back to whiskey. I like what that stuff does to you. It's kind of like closed umbrella going down, and it opens up all of a sudden. And with my very first drink of it, I was even more ashamed. I had in those days never heard the word alcoholic nor alcoholism, but I had heard the wino. I had stumbled over him going from my hotel to work. And if I had any compassion in my heart for one of them, it was the fact that he'd run out of money to buy another drink, I suppose. But I was so ashamed of that. And in my work, when I went back and forth from Sacramento to Reno, Nevada, I would go to some other place. I would never drink with my friends. Always go to the end of the street where you could be alone and nobody could see you drink. The shame. Well, I get down, I begin to hear the little people, see the little men, talk to myself. Something about that wine that is rather peculiar. And I go down in terrifically bad shape. With a siege, I do not know how long it lasted. It's a rather nebulous affair. I think some of us waste time trying to explain the obvious. And I staggered out of this place and went home to my wife. These were the first words I said to her. "I am sick." Somehow or other, I think that she knew that something hellish had happened. She kind of bought the idea. I never had been sick, really sick with a doctor, except this urban sick that you get every morning. I thought everybody threw up every morning. I didn't. I used to rent a hotel room with twin beds in it, one to sleep in, one to throw up in. We're very reluctant to call a physician. The only people we knew were these railroad physicians. And they've got that rule about drinking. But we were forced to, and this little fellow came down and looked at the corpse lying over there. And here come the wives again. He said to her, "Does he drink?" "Uh-uh," he said. I don't think she kidded him any, but he stood and told her that I was a very sick man. A lot of high-sounding terms there. And he said he needs to be in a hospital, and he gave her a prescription for some of the most delightful pills that I later learned to love. And a pop of the happy medicine in the arm. And they back the ambulance up to the door in Sacramento, and we go to San Francisco making 90 miles an hour with the red light on and the siren screaming, and I'm up in the back eating those pills. You know, I've always looked back on that trip with a feeling of irony. Here's a guy been drunk 18 years and they're in a hell of a hurry to do something about it. Right now. And when I got to the hospital, it was a day and a half before I saw a doctor. I guess they were out testing cigarettes, breaking the laxative habit. Science has made some great strides recently. And they put me through one of the most stringent clinics I suppose there is anywhere. From the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, and I'll say this, it's not a lot of fun with the shakes. Don't ever go to a proctologist with a hand hangover. And the result of it was that I had nothing organically wrong with me. Nothing organically wrong with me. And this was my introduction to psychiatry. I would like to make an humble statement that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, of my acquaintance who have had their alcoholism beaten out of them through their knees with a rubber mallet, are very few. But they brought in this frustrated piano tuner. Oh, we played games, we counted blocks, we sorted string. I became very adept at finger painting. And that bastard enjoyed every minute. No, none of you ever gonna drink anymore, so I'll let you in on a little secret. How to get rid of a psychiatrist. You let two drunks lay up one night drinking bromide and memorize the same dream to tell him the next morning. By God, they'll quiver. Well, I went through 3 months of seances with this cat, this reflex detective, and he prescribed a delightful little dose there that some of our girls in AA are quite fond of, sodium bromide elixir. This is the granddaddy of nerving, in case you didn't know what it is. You know, you've heard Aunt Minnie's nervous today. She can't come out. Hell, I know she can't. She's stoned. Well, sodium bromide elixir is clear. It tastes like seawater. Has no odor. And the marvelous thing about it is that food doesn't disturb it. And I kept it, he prescribed 5 little shot glasses a day to calm me down. And with my alcoholic reasoning, I figured that if 5 little shot glasses would calm me down, jug be a lot better. And there's not much wrong with it, really. Oh, there's a few little manifestations like crossed eyes and frothing at the mouth. Loss of memory. You talk about living a day at a time on AA. If you suck that bromide, you only live a few minutes. You don't know what happened a while ago. And you're not much concerned with what's going to happen here. Well, they cured me. That's it, they changed my diagnosis 4 times while I was in this hospital. I went all the way from nervous anxiety to ambulatory schizophrenia. Now, you know what an ambulatory schizophrenic is. That's a going, Jesse, with dual wheels. So, this skull jockey came in one day and he said to me, "You go on now." Oh, his eyes lit up and he rubbed his palms. That's a symptom of being a psychiatrist. And he gave me an admonition that no drunk should ever hear. "Take care of yourself and get plenty of rest." Rest from what? Hell, I haven't worked in years. Hey, so I go home, I got my cake and my eat it now. Got a disease, they talk about it in the bar. Got my wine working. Makes good conversation. You ever walk up to an old drunk sitting on the bar stool, punch him in the back real quick? You know what he'd say? "I've been sick." Well, this didn't last too long. It's too good to be true, really. Bartender double-crossed me. When you lose those friends, you're in trouble. He called my wife one day and he said, "Mrs. Leith, you think your husband is sick. Said you go to work, he gets up and comes down here. Said, then he runs home at 11:30 and gets in bed and lets you come home and fix his meal for him. Said, then in the afternoon he comes back down here." And he further added, "We don't want him." Well, this is a great blow to my wife. She'd set great store with the hospital kick. And she became quite perturbed and called this cat there in San Francisco long distance, this skull jockey. And I don't know what he told her, but this was when she left. I can say that with any rancor in my heart whatsoever, because I believe that you and me, as compulsive drinkers, as alcoholics, as we have been so described, will cling to every crutch at hand until some of us ultimately lose the last crutch will we ever take a look at ourselves. And the absence of my wife was only the absence of another crutch. Still had a few left. My railroad buddies loaded me in a baggage car, shipped me back to the hospital, and I shall say they weren't overjoyed to see my return. Still got to have an answer to what makes me tick. And they sent it out to the university and brought in a little Freudian fellow. And he looked like one. had the Van Dyke beard and the thick glasses like the bottom of a couple of beer bottles. And he ticked. And he didn't speak English, and I didn't speak what he spoke. But he finally got through the fog to me one vital question. He said, "Do you wet the bed?" This has always bugged me. That's a result of drinking and not a cause. I've killed more potted plants than I have wet. Well, we had another 3 months of this cat, and finally one day, this is not when we had the alcoholic facilities in our hospital to treat the drunk with like we now have, thank God. There was no such a thing as an alcoholic then. Were we not indebted to people who, like we have here, have given their all for such? No, you were a drunk. And as far as they were concerned, you were destined to die or do better. Well, one day the resident physician came to my nervous ward and beckoned me out silently, as though he were ashamed of it, actually. And he called me out into the hall and he said to me, he didn't want the other fellows to hear. He said, "We have come to the conclusion that most of your trouble is from drinking." Months and months of expensive treatment, science, and medicine, and he had finally made this profound discovery. He'd have just asked that bartender in Sacramento, he could have told him in a minute. And he said, "You got to get out of here and let some sick people come in." I'd been going around cheering up a few patients. I didn't have any place to go. He said, "Where's your people?" And I said, "Down in Texas." And I think his eyes lit up, actually. He said, "Go down there by all means." You see, this is a, let's face it, this is a rather obnoxious disease. People are not too fond of us when we are in, as the doctors say, extremis. When you're drunk. So the answer was get out. And they sent me to Texas. This guy gave me the same old admonition, take care of yourself and get plenty of rest. And they gave me a jug of bromide and 125 phenobarbital and headed me in the direction of Texas. And it's a rather, if I might say, nebulous trip. But I got there. Here's the city slicker, come home. The bright boy, the genius, no less. Come home, and I think really that the only reason I went was to die. Have nowhere else to go. But I found a small town psychiatrist down there, and I would name drop him. He was interested to know what was going on the West Coast, and he was a lonely little fella. And he loved to talk, and I would sit and listen to him for an hour, see? And he would give me goofballs with a popcorn sack full. This is too good to be true. And my own mother had me locked up in the local pokey. Well, this wasn't my first jail, nor was it my last. But there was something particularly cutting about it to me. Here I have come home and these people don't appreciate me anymore than this. And I remember when they loaded me out of this deep, sound sleep and carried me out of the house, I asked one of these fuzzies to help me tie my shoes, and he said, "Hell no," I said, "we've got plenty of time." I found out that they did. That's what these judges in courts, they give you a piece of the clock at the slightest provocation. That's the only commodity that they dispense is time. Just take your pick on how much you want. A few days later, and I have no way of knowing when you eat pills like I ate them, your calendar starts leaking. There came a fellow to my cell there whom I had never seen before. And I remember this because looking back on it, I actually think that it was a cruel scene from beginning to end. But this guy walked up to the cell, called for me by name, and I would like to say here that when you're in jail, you are a captive audience. You can't spin on your heel and walk out. And he said, "I am told that you're having some trouble with your drinking." And he proceeded to tell me about himself. What we've come to know is the AA pitch. He gave it to me that morning through those jail bars. What is the message of AA? We talk about it all the time, carrying the message of AA. I think that the very essence of the message of Alcoholics Anonymous is encompassed in five small words. I know how you feel. I think that anything else that we say is an embellishment upon that. But this guy came up there, and the first one that I had ever heard or listened to, a perfect stranger. And he said those five words, "I know how you feel." And I kind of halfway believed him. But I was so filled with resentment and hatred and bitterness that I asked him more than once, "Who sent you to see me?" That was who I particularly wanted to hate, you know. I went to see an old boy down in Texas not so long ago, and he rolled up off of that dirty sheet with them bloodshot eyes, and he said to me, "Who turned me in to that outfit?" I know just how he felt. And let me say one more thing, that this guy that came to see me that morning came unsolicited. Nobody called him. If he had waited to be called, you are looking at a dead man.
This is the end of side one.
What were the words that were spoken by our two founders of this program of Alcoholics Anonymous? If I remember them correctly, they go like this. Let us go out and find another drunk. Oh, I sit in the club, my God, and somebody says to me, "He or she don't need it." And I shudder in my boots to think, what if this guy hadn't come to see me that lousy Monday morning? But I didn't want it. Wouldn't take it. But he bugged me. Gave me a little piece of literature on the back of which was read, "Slaves of Drink Find Peace of Mind." It was a little piece of literature that had been printed in the South in those days. And he very calmly said, "If you don't ever want us, call us." And he left. I guess he went back and reported to my people. They're good, substantial citizens down there. And they paid two deputy sheriffs to load me into a police car and carry me 200 miles to Houston, Texas, and put me on a train going west.
This was their treatment for the disease of alcoholism. No family likes to admit that they've got one, and my family sure had one. It's time. I didn't go back to Los Angeles all in one big long hop. I got off of that train and filled a bag up with the only thing I know to fill a bag up with. And they carried me off in a wheelchair. Some smart aleck said, "You can't live in this car. We use it going in both directions." I had kind of set up shop in there. And they carried me very unceremoniously out into the front and dumped me in the front foyer. And with all the jocular remarks that I might make, all the levity, all the fun we have in looking back on it, I went through the next 5 months of living hell. Those of you who know about the Sacramento River back in the days, will bear me out. And I ended up in a flop house in Sacramento that had 18 beds in it. And every time I walk into an AA club and see the sign hanging on the wall, "But for the grace of God," I wonder what happened to the other 17 guys. Some of them, by a mere stretch of the imagination, could have been as smart as me. Some of them could have been as worthy as me. Some of them could have had some folks at home praying for them like I did. How come I'm the lucky guy? And it seemed to me that every night when I opened up one of these damn bags, that stinking little pamphlet was on top, like the shell game, and I could see it in a stupor. Slaves of drink find peace of mind. And I got up and staggered out of that place with pure brute force and awkwardness and went looking for the guy that gave it to me. Don't tell me we don't have to do it the hard way. I go 2,600 miles to find this fellow, and where I left from, a block and a half away, was an AA club. I gotta do it the dramatic way. When I get back home, they want to put me in. They believe this iron will cure alcoholism. But they put me in the back room and left me there to lay. And I asked them to call a guy to come see me. You know, the fabulous part of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the thing that makes a man make the second trip. My God, how long do you work for the drunk? This fellow could have well justified himself and said, "Well, I went to see that stinker up in jail up there. He's a nut. He's arrogant. He ain't ready." But here he comes again. This is the motivation that is beyond explanation, other than the handiwork of a loving God. And he took me to my first AA meeting. Why are they all upstairs? He shoved me up this dirty, dingy old stairs that night, and they're kind of cut on the bias. I figured, you know. And we go up. Dark, dirty, dingy place in an obscure place in the city. And he took me to my first AA meeting, and I've had to compare all other AA meetings with that. I don't remember a word that any of the elder statesmen said that night. I don't remember seeing any of the deacons bleed profusely. You know what I remember? I remember experiencing a communication that here are some people like me. And the sickening loneliness that plagues every alcoholic as long as he sits on that stool and drinks left me that night. And thank God it has never returned. Well, over to one side of me that night, you don't take the arrogance and the out of a guy in one cool treatment. There sat a fellow over there gently puffing on a cigar and a big diamond ring, and he had this serenity thing here. And I couldn't focus too well. I was still fading out on these pills, but I knew him. He bugged me the whole meeting. Mind you, I've been gone 18 years. And after the meeting, I discovered that I had soldiered with this fellow some 20 years prior to this time, and that the last time I had seen him, he was a blubbering idiot. The army had him chained to a post on a chain, and we would slip him whiskey just to watch him perform. He was a real idiot, like a monkey, yes. And here he sits this night in AA, gently puffing on that cigar, the diamond ring, and the AA fixture. And I looked at him and I thought, if it'll help him that much, it'll make a damn genius out of me. Well, the kicker was there that night. There was an old sheriff there who was sober then 2 years, and he had his pistols on that night and had come to the meeting. And he came up and gave me a thing that I feel so strongly anytime I'm with another alcoholic. He put his arm around me and he said, "I love you, boy, and you can stay sober just like I do." And he got me. I'm firmly convinced that the possibility of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in action and the rehabilitation of an alcoholic hinges purely and simply upon a thing called love. Here is the symbol of everything that I hated, this dirty old sheriff. And he said, "I love you, boy, and you can stay sober just like I do." Well, I began to get well. Got well a little too fast, I think. Went through those growing stages. You've seen them. God, they're glorious to watch. I quit swearing. Wouldn't steal. Wouldn't say any bad words. In fact, I think it became God-like. You ever met any God-like AA members? They're hell, ain't they? I remember one night I got a call to go pick up a drunk. He was in the restaurant, and the restaurant owner had taken his jug away from him, and that's really what he wanted, was to retrieve that jug. But I couldn't see it. I was too godlike. And I take another buddy, and I get the drunk in his jug, and I put him in the car between me. Oh, God, I felt good. And I began to talk to him eloquently as we drove slowly along. And his eyes began to water, and I thought to myself, "I'm getting him." And as I talked on, he gently lay his head over on my shoulder. And I knew I had it. Did you ever hear of anybody throwing up silently? every time I've ever gotten godlike is when I'm in the cue card. I don't know how long he worked for the drunk. I worked with one down here in Texas for 4.5 years. Called one Sunday morning and my wife said, "Yeah, Joe, come." I went. He was sick, scurvier than I was when I came to AA, actually. That's possible. He's verging on DTs, and I borrowed a goblet of booze, poured it down him, knocked him out, really. And when he kind of came unshackled from this drink, he was in an AA club. And he got sober. And he stayed sober for about 3 months, and I went and got him again. And I worked with him some more. And this was a process that went on for an interminable length. And I just knew that this guy had to sober up under my direction. I kind of made a side project out of him, you know. And I thought, "God, you've been watching him sparrows too much to let me have it." He is about to get me, but I'm not going to give up. About 7 years ago, he got on for him what I hope was his last drunk. And he called another fella from our club who's not half as smart as I am. And he went out and talked to that bastard 10 minutes, and he'd been sober ever since. And I would sit in the club and look at him and think, "You ought to be mine." God has given us, I owe him more. He owes me. He kept me sober for 4.5 years. I don't know how to explain the happiness that we find in AA. The achievements that we make. One night in our group, that we were having a little session in the back, and there was a little fellow back there who called himself an air conditioning engineer. And he was discussing the theory of air conditioning, and he wasn't a profound man, but he said, "There's no such thing as cold, there's only an absence of heat." Well, that may be true. They sell a lot of air conditioning equipment on that theory. But to me, the essence of AA is the absence of a lot of things that used to happen to me and now don't. I don't have to run anymore. I don't have to feel ashamed anymore. I don't have to make excuses anymore. So maybe the thing is the absence of a few things. I couldn't tell you how I feel about being the lucky guy that's sober. Unless maybe it would be with a little anecdote about the greatest 12-step call I ever heard of. This was the average 12-step call, just like some that you and I have made. The only difference was that it was made 2,000 years ago. I found it in a very obscure place in the scripture. And it's the story of the maniac. Or as they termed him then, it was written by a doctor, a physician, and very abstractly. He tells the story of the guy, the maniac, or the demoniac, which actually in simple languages means a maniac full of demons. Today, with psychiatry like it is, they would have classified him as something else. But this guy said that no man could tame him, that they had to keep him in fetters and chains. He was wild, like me. That the manifestations of his disease became so bad that they had to run him out of town. Like me. And he ended up out on the riverbank doing the best he could, like me, eating with pigs. Well, there seemed to have been at that time a little carpenter fellow wandering about the country with a new philosophy of love. He could see no ill in anyone, and he said to this old boy, "What seemed to be the trouble?" He said, "Well, I can't tell you. I've got so many that they call me Legion. That's all I am, is trouble." Well, the little carpenter fellow saw that he needed a little help, and as the story goes, and it is written verbatim, it says that he was healed immediately. Must have had a disease. Then it said that when the people came to see them, that there he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. We've got a step like that. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. There he sat, fully clothed and in his right mind. But then, like today, some of the populace didn't particularly appreciate the manner in which this man had been healed. And they came out en masse and prevailed upon him to get out. I can see the drunk, timid, with his newfound sobriety, not knowing what to do, dependent upon some power that he can't describe, and he looked at the little carpenter and said, "Let me go with you." The little carpenter gave him an admonition that I can pass on to you. "No," he said, "stay here so that others can see what has happened to you. Thank you."
Each year, it seems like, and I mean to we that work on it, it gets greater and greater. And we are so grateful for people like this and our other speakers that we had last night and today, and the two wonderful ones you will hear tomorrow. And it absolutely makes me so grateful to God as I understand Him. But a little over 18 years ago, He let me come off of the skids in Phoenix and get to my first AA meeting. A complete lonely, beat-down guy with nothing to give to anybody. All alone, had nothing left. And somehow or other, even though as I didn't believe in him, at that time, he guided me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. It has not been necessary either for me to take a drink since my first meeting. And I am so grateful for this because when I come into AA, I had abused myself so badly, physically, for so long that the doctors said I couldn't live from a cirrhosis of the liver. Even as I got sober and stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, they still said it is impossible. But nevertheless, by this time, I had met some wonderful people. People that loved me because they knew I wanted what they had. And at that first meeting in Phoenix, which I particularly never want to forget this evening, I heard those beautiful words. And I did take something from my first meeting, even I was sick. And it came to us from our big book. And I always like to remember it. Because that night I thought that this chairman, as he read those words from that big book, and he told me, which I knew it was to be true later as I read them myself, that they came from the founder of this great fellowship. And it seemed that evening a lot of loneliness left me. And I felt that he wasn't talking to anybody else in the room that night but me. And if you may be having a little lonely period now and new in Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe as I say to you this evening in closing, it may help you to get rid of a little of the heartaches that you might have. Because he said to me that night, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you tread the road of happy destiny. And he ends it up by saying in there, one of our founders, may God bless you and keep you until then. And I say to you in closing this evening, may God bless you and keep you always. Because I know a lot of you may feel that I probably do, because there is no perfection, and we strive for spiritual progress, that I may get feeling a little sorry for myself now and then, because maybe it is a little hard work for something like this. But the rewards that you people give to me individually, and to my wonderful wife who will be with me 31 years this year, and to know that I have my daughter and my son-in-law here tonight, they're both of them here, and the other one is over, she's ill, came down with the flu this afternoon. But these are the things that make me so grateful to God on a day-by-day basis. And if you think that I individually am doing something for you, you should know what you do for me and how you help me by your enthusiasm and by your attendance at this roundup every year. And now, after a moment of meditation, for those that choose to join us, we always end any AA meeting with the Lord's Prayer. And tonight I'd like to ask a very dear friend of mine, Margie Adler, sitting right up here in the front, if she will lead us in this Lord's Prayer.
Due to the length of this reel-to-reel when it was converted to a tape cassette, I have put the first of the meeting with Jack B. as the Master of Ceremonies, so please continue to listen and I'll get as much as I can on it.
Welcome to the 6th annual banquet of the Desert Roundup, and I hope you enjoyed your dinner. The air conditioning will be turned on eventually. The security guards are now released. Sit down and shut up. Although I'm not supposed to be here tonight, I'm very happy to be here. And if you care to, while we're waiting for Joe Kirk and a few of the other late arrivals, you may write in your programs, Jack Bailey, sub-chairman. As a matter of fact, Maury wanted George Jessel to do this tonight at the banquet. But George Jessel could not be here because he and Anthony Quinn had to attend the meeting of Fathers Anonymous. that there is a special edition to the show tonight that was not in your program. Immediately after the regular show, and before the dancing starts, if you care to come over by the pool, Chuck Chamberlain and I are doing the Old Soft Shoe on the Waters. Or something. Did you practice, Chuck? Tonight, we are going to have very few introductions by me. We're going to ask you, as always, at banquets... Oh, my God, there's somebody dropped their bucket. ...to withhold your applause till it's all over at the head table. And you never do, but it's always protocol to ask you for that. And I'll ask them to remain seated until it's all over. No, to remain standing until it's all over. I think that's the way it works. If I may be permitted to pick a queen of the roundup, and I may, because queening is my business, eh, Maury? I would say that Miss Pat Oliver, who wrote that wonderful article in the Desert Palm Spring Life magazine, is certainly a queen in our book. So, Miss Oliver, without any applause, don't clap. Will you put your fork down, please, and stand and stay there for a long time? Next to her is Father Fred, who spoke so beautifully today at the family group. Father Fred is from the East. Don't prompt, I don't know what I'm doing. You get your turn later. Verena Kirk, Joe Kirk's wife. And Joe Kirk is putting on his work act. He isn't up here yet. But wherever Joe is, we love him.
Very exciting.
Great. From the headquarter office, New York City, New York, Hazel Rice has honored us, and we'll swing out tomorrow. Next to her, a special tribute should be paid to the man who brought AA for the first time behind any locked door in the world in the early 1940s. Ladies and gentlemen, our honored guest, the ex-warden of San Quentin, Mr. Clinton Duffy. Smile, Clint. He's a wonderful man, and he drove all the way in from Palm Desert last night just to clip me for a free dinner. Reordered that boy. And now from the Deep South, we'd like you to meet Mrs. Mary Leeth. L-E-E-T-H. It's L-E-E here, and don't argue. I'd like to have you meet now the President of the United States, Mr. Lyndon B. Johnson. Doesn't he look like him? He scared me half to death. I thought old Maury'd do it. There he is. This was really my idea because I know, as Maury laughingly said, he was going to get the Pope next year. I got old LB this year. Hi. That's actually Joel. You'll hear a lot more from him later. And now I'd like to have you meet the lovely Vera Scanlon, who puts up with more than any of us will ever know. Vera S. Yes, I think so. Forget it. I'd like to have you meet my wife, Carol. Stand up, honey. Our wonderful secretary and a real dynamo and has done a wonderful job. I'd like to have you meet Marty A. You're not supposed to be clapping, you know. And her husband by marriage, Chet A.
Next to her is Ora Johnson's wife and the chief of police, Ora Johnson. Again, our guest tonight. Will you please rise and don't speak? All through the lecture on the evils of drink last night by that judge, he kept talking about mama, mama. And I don't blame her for resenting the fact he never calls her by her right name. He's been sober for a long time, married 35 years, and he can never think of her name. Some are sicker than others. And that judge is... This is Dorothy Harrison, mama. Next is a man that I've known for many years. I got at the University of Drake the year he got out, and that's the truth. And when I was in Des Moines, Iowa, I found him.